Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, political engagement. Voters will head to the polls for congressional midterm elections in just a few weeks. But according to some estimates, voter turnout is likely to be lower than in previous years. So is that because we're sick and tired of politics? Apathetic about the issues and candidates? Or are we just too busy to care? In this hour, what would it take to make politics more fun and engaging for everyone? Here's one example. You know those notices you get for local public hearings? Water quality, street maintenance, school board? Well, if you're like me, you're not exactly rearranging your life to attend them. I mean, yes, they matter, but they're just kind of boring. Josh Lerner thinks local governments could boost the fun factor in the political process by borrowing ideas from game design. He's watched this happen in places like Venezuela, Canada, and Argentina, and he writes about it in a book called Making Democracy Fun. Charles Monroe Kane asked where he went and what he saw.
In Argentina, I did research on several local government programs. One of them was a program called Rosario Habitat, which was designed to redevelop the shanty towns. So in Argentina, like a lot of Latin American countries, there are extremely poor shanty towns scattered across the city. So shacks built of scavenged material, of cardboard, of metal planks, no streets, no safe access to running water, electricity, sewage. And the city wanted to change this and turn these neighborhoods into actual communities where people might want to live and which could be more functional and healthy. So they did this through a program where they asked residents in those shantytowns to decide on new plans for their neighborhoods. And it was really challenging at first, and they actually failed miserably. And the first few meetings, they ended up getting chased out of the shantytown by residents, and actually staff got stabbed by some of the residents. So they decided that they had to try something different, and that's when they brought in games.
They brought in games. I hear you say that. What does that mean?
So first, they integrated games directly into the meetings. So for example, they invited people in the shantytown in this one block into a community center, into a big room, and passed out a bag to each table, and it was full of puzzle pieces. And they asked people first to put the pieces together in their teams in each table. And folks were trying to put the pieces together but couldn't quite figure it out. So then the facilitator, this woman, Luciana, said, okay, now you can talk with people at other tables, which hadn't actually been against the rules, just no one had thought of it because they were sitting at their own tables. And so quickly they got up, went to their tables, and realized that each table had a missing piece from their tables. And it quickly transformed what had been a very individualistic setting of people wanting better houses for their own family into more of a collaborative environment where people recognize they needed to work together to tackle these big challenges.
So everyone's got the puzzle pieces they've gotten. They got the idea they can work together, a little bit empowered. Now what happens?
Yeah, so this is where it gets trickier, where you have to actually make decisions. And that's what I think there's the biggest potential for growth and for learning from games. So the next step was they had to decide on rules for how they were going to proceed with the process. So there were some fixed rules by the program, things like if you want to install a new street so that you can have access to water and electricity and sewage, then the people who would be displaced by that street would have to move, but they'd also get new houses that the city would provide for free. Any houses that would be built, any new houses, would have to be at least 90 meters squared. So there are these technical constraints, other ones like that. But then there's the question of, let's say that there's only space for two families and there's three families that want to live in a certain area. How do you decide which families stay and which families go? And so first they started by deciding on rules for this. So how would you prioritize who would stay and who would go? And they asked folks to identify criteria they would use to decide on that. So for example, if someone had a job nearby, if they had a physical disability, if they were a single parent. And so they asked for those ideas, and then people actually, they brainstormed them, and then the residents themselves voted on which of those were most important. So they ended up with a list of ranked priorities for deciding who would stay and who would go in cases where there was conflict. Following that, then came the really tricky part of deciding where people's houses would go, where people would move to. And for that, what they did is fascinating. They basically adapted the game Tetris. So they had these maps of the blocks, and cut out different shapes from kind of colored transparency paper. So there were, you know, purple rectangles and green squares and L's, each of them representing 90 meters squared, which is that basic minimum lot size. And they asked the residents themselves to rearrange the pieces on a map to decide basically on a new land use plan.
That's so interesting. So how did it work out in the end? Was there conflict?
Yeah, so there was conflict during that, and I don't want to say it's a conflict-free process. No. What the game did is it made that conflict more manageable and it allowed people to overcome it. So there were people who didn't want to move, and they started out the process not wanting to move, and it was through this game where some of that conflict was displaced onto the map. So it wasn't me versus you, it wasn't neighbor versus neighbor, it was how are we going to rearrange these pieces on a map? And so that refocused people's attention so that they were able to step back a bit from their personal conflicts and reach agreements. For example, there was this one guy, Mario, at one of the workshops, and this was probably the second or third workshop. So they already started developing the plan, they had some basic contours for it, and this guy Mario, this big beefy guy, had a, you know, pulled back hair, the little cap on, and he's just staring at the map as people are going through this exercise. And suddenly he points to this one spot in the map where there's a road, and he's very furious and just yells out, you know, that's my house. And you can see there's even a skull tattoo on his hands, and he's saying, you know, my dad built that house with his bare hands. I've lived there my entire life, and now you're saying that I have to move because the city wants to put a road there. And he was furious, and I should mention, too, that this is in a situation of a lot of violence. So there had actually been, in addition to the stabbing I mentioned before, there had been a few gunpoint robberies of staff in the weeks beforehand where residents of this same shantytown had come into the office and pointed a gun at staff's head and robbed them right there in the office in broad daylight and walked back out. So I didn't know what was going to happen, to be honest. I started inching towards the door. The facilitators looked at each other nervously. And that's when the most amazing thing happened, where the facilitators didn't say anything. I didn't say anything. Actually, this guy's neighbors spoke up, and they're like, whoa. The reason the road is going here is because of the rules that we agreed on, because this is the only way that we're going to get running water, that we're going to get electricity, that we're going to get our own land. And you will get a new house. You will get a new house that's actually better than your current one on a new plot of land, and you'll get to decide where that is. And gradually started explaining to this guy how it was part of this whole system they had agreed on that was resulting in him moving. And he still wasn't happy by any means, and he asked staff to go check with the planning department and see if they could redesign the street. But he said, you know, if they can't, I'll move. It's okay.
You know, I hear what you're saying, but it's still very local. It's very, very locally participatory, right? Like, this is my house, the road that affects my life. If you extrapolate this out to a bigger area, to a state, to a nation, how does this work on a much bigger scale, like a national scale? Can it?
They certainly can. I mean, maybe just to get there, we'll take it up one level higher, so the city level. So in a large city. And so one of the other programs I looked at was in Toronto Community Housing. And second largest housing authority in North America, 164,000 tenants, people living across the city in a wide range of buildings. And the city there launched a program called participatory budgeting, which I also do a lot of work on outside of the book. And basically it let residents of these buildings decide how to spend a part of the housing authority's budget through a format that used a lot of games and game design like I described in Rosario, where people themselves were putting together proposals, voting on them, working in teams, and through that deciding how to spend real money across the entire city.
But as we know, I mean, I'm in America, right? I mean, I think you had in your book, but there's a recent poll that said only 22% of Americans trust their government at all. Do you think games could restore faith that's gone that far away from what we believe in?
I do. I think games and really game design, that's what I emphasize most in the book. It's not just about sprinkling in a game here and there. It's about rethinking the system of democracy and redesigning it so that it's more engaging for folks who are currently excluded from or marginalized by that system. And I think it's actually essential to the health of our democracy. So I don't see games as something that's frivolous, but rather that's critical for having a representative, healthy democracy.
I can see someone out there who's like, games, the word game, it's trivial. The word fun is trivial. And by framing it that way, you're not taking democracy seriously. What do you do with the critics on the words like fun and game? How do you handle that when people are like, man, these are games. Where, you know, that's cute, but we need to do something serious.
Part of it comes down to understanding of the word fun. And I think there's a common misconception about fun that we think of fun as we're sitting back laughing, this wild smile on our face. and maybe laying on the beach, doing something that's utterly pointless. And that's actually not when we're enjoying ourselves the most. So if you think about the things that are most fun to you, often you have a really serious look on your face. So if you're playing a video game or a sport, or even if you're through work, I mean, I imagine that for a surgeon, doing a surgery can be fun. It's testing their abilities, that they're in this flow state where they're using maximal use of their abilities to try something that's hard and feeling a real sense of achievement from that. So that's actually when we have the most fun, is when we're applying ourselves in a meaningful and fulfilling way. And I think that's what democracy should be. The other thing is, I think people want to have a say over the decisions that affect their lives. And if government can offer that to them, then people will want to participate more. So it's, in a sense, asking them to participate more, but I would reframe it a bit as inviting them to participate. Mm-hmm. So rather than having participation be this kind of civic chore that you should participate in because it's good for the country, if we can reframe that as democracy being something that actually you want to participate in, that in your free time you see that as valuable, enjoyable, and as worthwhile as, you know, say, sitting in front of the TV doing nothing. And I think that's certainly feasible. And we're seeing all across the world that people are engaging in meaningful ways in all kinds of things besides government and things that don't really have much impact in their lives. So for me, it's more of a paradox that making decisions that affect people's lives, you know, that should be interesting. That should be meaningful for people. And it's impressive how we've made that so unappealing.
Josh Lerner is the executive director of the Participatory Budgeting Project and the author of Making Democracy Fun: How Game Design Can Empower Citizens and Transform Politics. One thing that's made democracy more fun, or at least more engaging for a whole generation of young people, is that little thing called the internet. Whether it's in Egypt, Tunisia, or more recently Hong Kong, young activists all over the world are using social media to mobilize and demand change. Emily Parker profiles a few of them in a new book called Now I Know Who My Comrades Are. She shared a few stories with Steve Paulson, starting with a young Chinese blogger named Michael Anti.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting because he didn't start out as a young journalist and a political blogger. He actually started out as a loyal believer in the Communist Party of China. And so in 1989, when there were protests all over China, Anti believed the version that he heard on television, which was that these were counter-revolutionary, violent students basically attacking the army. And so in 1999, 10 years after the Tiananmen crackdown, Anti downloaded a newsletter from an overseas dissident website. This was blocked in China, but he was very technologically savvy and found a way to access it, and found photos and first-person accounts. And in those moments, when he saw this version of the story that his government had been trying to hide, his whole world came crashing to the ground.
So one of the great virtues, I guess you could say, of the internet is it simply provides information that some governments don't want you to see.
Well, so that's a big part of it. But I think actually what's most transformative about the internet in countries like China is not its ability to promote freedom of speech, but its ability to promote freedom of assembly. So what's most important about Michael Anti's transformation is not just his discovery, it's the fact that on the internet, he found other people who were like him. And in China, the government is very threatened by any kind of physical gathering of critics or any physical gathering of dissidents. So if you don't agree with the government, if you don't agree with the official version of history, you're not going to find a lot of people in the physical world who think like you. But on the internet, Anti found hundreds, thousands, who knows how many people who were kind of in his camp. And that's where the title of my book comes from. I asked Anti, you know, in China where the internet is so censored, why does the internet matter? And he said, because now I know who my comrades are. Now I know that I'm not alone. Hmm. And that was a revolutionary realization for him.
I mean, so this is interesting. I mean, it sounds like from the perspective of the Chinese government, I mean, the big threat is that people will mobilize and get out into the streets and actually protest what the government is doing, more than saying critical things about the government on the internet.
That is 100% right. That is absolutely right. And there have been studies of censorship of the Chinese internet that show that the most sensitive messages online in China are not messages that necessarily criticize the government. They're messages that suggest, let's get together, let's form some sort of collective action, let's do something together. The government is so much more worried about collective action than they are worried about freedom of expression. And so what's really important is this idea that thanks to the internet, all these individuals in China are learning that they're not alone. And even if that assembly is only virtual for now, it's still this, now I know who my comrades are, that realization is life-changing in China.
Well, I'm wondering how these issues play out in other repressive countries as well. I mean, Cuba, for instance. I mean, you
yes.
have been there, and there is also a certain degree of fear and paranoia about mm-hmm. what you can say. I mean, there's surveillance is common. How does the internet play out over there?
Cuba is obviously quite different from China. You know, China, you're looking at, again, hundreds of millions of internet users. Cuba has a tiny internet penetration rate. Very few Cubans are online, largely because, you know, they don't have internet access at home, and it's very expensive for them to access the internet. And so what the internet does do in Cuba for the few Cubans that actually access it is it's the one place where they feel like they can sort of speak freely. You know, if somebody wants to just go online and talk about the realities that they see outside their window, the internet and blogs is the one place where they can do this. So the Cuban bloggers that I met also said that the internet was transformative for them because it was the one place where they felt free.
Now,
it was
when they're blogging online, I mean, are they being monitored by the government?
They're being monitored pretty much all the time. And what's really interesting about the bloggers that I met in Cuba is that they had kind of come to a point where they said, you know what, I'm going to say what I think and I'm going to speak freely and I don't care if I'm being monitored. It was sort of that feeling where they just decided they didn't care anymore.
Well, you also have some personal experience in sort of dealing with the paranoia that a lot of Cubans
sure.
face. I mean, you write about a time when you were staying with a family there and you started getting questioned about what you were doing there as a journalist.
I think that the paranoia in Cuba is quite abstract, and I found it rather ubiquitous. And one of the phrases that I heard over and over again in Cuba was, you never know who is who. You know, Cuba kind of operates on this network of citizen informers. So it's this idea that anyone could inform on you. It could be your neighbor, it could be the storekeeper, it could be the guy who runs the cafe. You just don't know. And so you kind of fear everyone. But the Cuban bloggers I met actually had decided that they were not going to be crippled by this. And I describe an anecdote with one well-known Cuban blogger. We were in a cafe, and he noticed that two girls at a nearby table were kind of looking at a camera. And he thought that they were subtly aiming the camera at us, that they were taking pictures of us. And now this sounds totally crazy unless you've been to Cuba. and you know, he's a very high-profile blogger. His name is Reynaldo. He's married to, or he's the partner of, Yoani Sanchez, who's the most famous blogger in Cuba. So he wasn't crazy, I mean, to think that this might be happening. But what's really interesting about this story is that I think a lot of people in this situation would have said, oh, I think they're taking pictures of us. Maybe we should go. Maybe we should end this meeting. Maybe we should lower our voices. Maybe we should speak differently. Instead, he took out his phone and took a picture of the girls. And he said, if they're taking a picture of me, I'm going to take a picture of them. It's only fair. But I think the point that he was making was that I am not going to be a passive object in a surveillance photo. I'm just not going to do that. I'm going to take this back. And I sort of saw that behavior among a lot of the Cuban bloggers that I met, this sense of empowerment, this sense of I found my voice, I speak freely, people outside the country know who I am, and I just refuse to be crippled by paranoia.
Well, you also write about another country, Russia,
yes.
and how mm-hmm. the internet is reinvigorating activists there. You say that the big problem there is apathy. I mean, there's not many people think the political process matters.
Yes. You know, when I went to Russia to live in 2010, you're exactly right. It was the country was crippled not by fear or isolation, but apathy. There was this sense that, you know, some 85% of Russians believe that they didn't have any effect on their political process. And the internet, just by existing, is not going to change that reality. So Russia actually, until fairly recently, had a pretty free internet, believe it or not. And yet, it was not really being used for activism. So I was fascinated by this puzzle. And what's fascinating, though, is that within basically the span of around a year, that reality totally changed. You know, in late 2011, early 2012, Russia saw some of the largest protests since the fall of the Soviet Union, and social media played a pretty large role.
Hmm. Well, you write about one internet activist, Alexei Navalny, who's trying to combat corruption by mobilizing
yes.
people, but through his own version of activism on the internet. Tell us about him.
Navalny was not only trying to combat corruption, that was the thrust of his internet campaigns, he was also trying to combat apathy. And that's what's really fascinating about Navalny. So what Navalny would do is, you know, he was confronted with a population that was basically exhausted. You know, a lot of them were not happy with politics. They didn't feel like they were living in a democracy, but they had no energy to go to street protests. They had really no energy to fight. They just thought nothing is going to change anything here anyway. So what Navalny did was he showed them that through the internet, they could actually achieve incremental changes. So he'd start all these kind of online campaigns and these online collective action campaigns. You know, they could be for crowdsourcing scrutiny over government spending. And by doing that, he showed ordinary Russians that they could make a difference. And it's really funny because here in the U.S., I don't know if you're familiar with this term, but the term slacktivism,
yeah.
you know, which is derisive. It means, you know, one-click activism. You know, I'm willing to support this cause on Facebook, but I will not go out in the streets. Navalny brilliantly used slacktivism to his advantage. He kind of set up these very easy online campaigns for ordinary Russians, kind of showing them that by clicking something from their living rooms, they can make a difference. And the way Navalny phrased it to me, he said, I propose to people the comfortable way of struggle. You know, I'm showing people that they can potentially, you know, get a pothole fixed, achieve some scrutiny over government spending, possibly get a corrupt official fired from the convenience of their living rooms from behind a laptop. You know, and years and years and years of these campaigns, you know, he sort of built up his following and also showed ordinary Russians that they could make a difference. And I think that's one of the reasons why Navalny was able to go from basically a blogger to the most prominent opposition figure in Russia.
Right. So if we step back from these particular cases, do you think the internet is actually creating a new kind of citizen, a more
yes.
politically engaged citizen?
Yes, I do. And here's where I have to give, you know, the disclaimer that, you know, the internet is a double-edged sword, right? And the internet does not only create, you know, Democrats. The internet can also be used by nationalists and fascists and racists. I mean, I that's important to say, right? But yes, I do think the internet is creating a new kind of citizen because in the three countries that I observed, China, Cuba, and Russia, over the course of a decade of research and reporting, you know, I observed two main things. One, isolation, fear, and apathy are among the most powerful weapons of authoritarian regimes, right? An isolated, apathetic, and afraid population is just not going to resist. You know, these are psychological impediments that very effectively prevent resistance. The second thing I observed is that thanks to the internet, people are getting over these obstacles. People are getting over their isolation by finding that they are not alone. They are getting over their fear by finding that they have a voice. And they are getting over their apathy by realizing that they can make a difference. And the internet has been pivotal in that transformation. So yes, I think that you are seeing a new kind of citizen who is basically networked, unafraid, and ready for action.
Emily Parker is a digital diplomacy advisor and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Her new book is Now I Know Who My Comrades Are, Voices from the Internet Underground. When we come back, a philosopher makes the case that here in the U.S., a lot of us vote so badly, we should probably just not vote. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about political engagement. You know that saying, if you can't do something well, don't do it at all? Well, maybe that should apply to voting. Georgetown University philosopher Jason Brennan says too many Americans vote badly, and he thinks our elections would actually yield better results if more of us just stayed home.
The basic thought here is that how we vote makes a difference. We're not simply choosing flag colors or the national anthem, but we're picking policy. So the thought here is that to make an informed choice requires a tremendous amount of knowledge, and there's good reason to think that a large percentage of the American public doesn't have this knowledge.
Wow, you don't think much of your fellow citizens.
Well, in a sense, I do. I like to think of it as I have a very populist view of civic virtue with an elitist view of voting ethics. So my view is something like, it's hard to vote well, but that doesn't mean you can't contribute in a positive way. There's lots of other things that we can do and that are more value to society than voting, really.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about what it means to vote badly. I mean, I was looking over some things that you've written, and in a recent paper you wrote, many of my fellow citizens are incompetent, ignorant, irrational, and morally unreasonable about politics.
That's right.
that's a really, wow, you think a lot of Americans are not even competent to vote. So why?
I think here the thing is not that people are dumb. It's that they have very bad incentives. The problem is that one individual vote doesn't make any difference. And that's why most people are likely to vote badly, because the consequences are so small. So the thought here is it's clear that we are incentivized through the political process to indulge our biases, to think kind of irrationally about politics, to use politics as a team-building exercise. It's us, the good Democrats, versus the evil Republicans, or vice versa, and to not really pay much attention to politics. So most people, when they do polls of political information, most people know hardly anything. Like in the year 2000, slightly more than half of voters knew that Gore was more liberal than Bush. But then if you ask them follow-up questions to try to find out if they know what the word liberal means, it seems like they don't. And that's among voters, and voters know more than the average person.
Well, I guess I'm sort of wondering, even if a lot of people vote badly, and and you've certainly laid out the case that we're a nation of political incompetence, don't even stupid people have a right to vote?
Yeah. So the question here is, do they have a right to vote versus is it the right thing to do? And you can have the right to do something, but it not be the right thing to do. So I have a right to free speech, which means that other people shouldn't oppress me. They shouldn't interfere with my speech. They shouldn't throw me in jail. And one of the things I can do with my right to free speech is, say, advocate the genocidal slaughter of Jews. You know, I can advocate Nazism. Now, it's wrong for me to do that, but I have the right to do it. So there's all sorts of things that we have the right to do that other people should let us do, but nevertheless that we shouldn't do. In the book of the Ethics of Voting, what I'm saying is you should think of voting as having a duty of care. In the same way that if you were a juror on a capital murder trial, you should pay attention to the information that's presented to you, the information that's relevant to deciding whether or not the person's guilty. You should process that information as scientifically as possible, and then you should vote in a morally reasonable way. So you wouldn't say the person's not guilty because, you know, it's a woman and you think she's pretty, or you wouldn't decide to say the person is guilty because he's Muslim and you don't like Muslims.
Yeah. Well, you've also made an argument for restricted suffrage. And So, frankly, as a woman, a member of a group that was only granted the right to vote, you know, relatively recently, even the phrase restricted suffrage opens up all kinds of ugly vistas. We've got this long history in this country and obviously others of those in power keeping themselves in power by restricting the rights of others to vote. I mean, why would you even want to open the door to that kind of disempowerment?
Right. So, you know, the paper you're talking about, it's a philosophy paper, primarily was aimed at other philosophers. And here what the goal of that was to say was, in the past, we've restricted voting for all sorts of crazy bad reasons, just, you know, things having to do with gender and race that have nothing to do with the quality of voting. But that doesn't mean that it's inherently objectionable to restrict voting. In the same way that if we were deciding that we're not going to let any homosexuals drive just because they're homosexual, well, that's a really bad reason to restrict people from driving. But on the other hand, saying we shouldn't let some people drive because they're incompetent to drive and their driving imposes a risk upon others, that seems like a good reason. So when I say, at least in principle, we shouldn't let people vote who are going to impose too much risk upon others, that seems like, in principle, that's okay with me. The question here is just, is it possible to implement that system without it being abused?
Yeah, unlike some of your analogies, you're talking about a system of political power. I mean, the right to access to education in our country is not necessarily completely fair. So if you're basing the right to vote on how educated somebody is and how much information they consume, you're leaving out huge swaths of the population.
Yeah, that's right. And this is, I call this the demographic objection to the kind of arguments I present. We know from all sorts of studies that political information is not evenly distributed. It tends to correlate positively with being white, with being male, with having higher income, with having higher IQ, with being employed. It tends to correlate negatively with being black, with being a woman, with being poor, with being uneducated, et cetera, et cetera. So political knowledge correlates with all the things that make you advantage, and it correlates negatively with the things that make you disadvantage. So let's just say instead of having a restriction of the right to vote, we just say, if you're not a good voter, stay home. You should voluntarily abstain. If people follow that advice, you'd get a disproportionately white, male, educated voting electorate as opposed to having something that represents the country as a whole. So that does seem on its face to be a worry, but there's a couple of reasons why I think that's not as big of a worry as it seems at first glance. So let's say you have a large percentage of people choose not to vote, and they all belong to a certain demographic. Is that going to be to their disadvantage or not? Well, it depends, first of all, on how many of them there are, but it also depends upon what they know. So let's say you've got a bunch of people living in the inner city, they're neglected, they get lousy education, and they end up not voting. Is that going to hurt them? It kind of depends on what they're voting for. It's easy for them to have good, what we might call outcome preferences, where they know that they want lower crime. They know that they want higher employment rates. They know that like things are not good. But it's difficult to have good, what we might call policy preferences, knowledge about what policy instruments will actually achieve those goals. So if you want to cut unemployment, should the government spend more money? Should the government spend less money and contract taxes? To know that kind of thing, you need to know economics, and most people don't know that. So what I tend to think here is—
So are you suggesting that if just the quote-unquote elites and informed people voted, they'd somehow vote in the best interests of the poor inner city uninformed voters?
If only the kinds of people, I know it sounds really extreme, but like if only the kinds of people that I think of as good voters were to vote, I think it'd be more likely to promote the interests of inner city people than to just have inner city people vote. And here's why, because we can look at the kinds of things that people advocate and why they advocate them. And we have find that the policy preferences of the elite tend to match up to what economists think. So they'll say things like, we need to have different kinds of education. We need to experiment with paying people to do private education. We need to reduce the drug war. That's a big, big thing. And so when I look at the policy preferences of what I would consider elite voters versus what I consider non-elite voters, the policy preferences of the elite voters look to me like they're the ones that would tend to match up with what economists think. And the other thing that you can do here is using a method developed by a political scientist named Scott Althaus is you can survey people and ask them what their policy preferences are. You can then give them a quiz of basic political knowledge, and at the same time, you can collect their demographic information. How much money do they make, what their sex is, how much education they have, and so on. And once you have all that information together, who they are, what they believe, and what they know, you can figure out statistically using kind of first semester statistics, what would the American public want if only it were fully informed? So here you're correcting for the fact that there's demographic differences and just asking what difference does information by itself make, correcting for the fact that some people are whiter than others.
Well, then why bother having elections at all then?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting proposal here I've been toying with recently. Why not, instead of having the kind of election that we have now where we ask the unenlightened public what does it want, why don't we ask the enlightened public what it wants? Why don't we collect this information and then figure out based upon that information, what would the public want if we keep everyone exactly the same in terms of their demographics, but made everybody fully informed? And what we find is an interesting set of things. It's neither very Republican nor very Democrat. It's Republican in some things, it's Democrat in others. So, you know, people want to increase taxes overall, but they also want overall freer trade. They want to have more abortion rights. And they want a different set of environmental protections than the ones that we actually have, and et cetera, et cetera. I tend to think that that's evidence that that's what we should be doing rather than the things that we actually tend to vote for.
I am slightly stunned. It sounds like you're suggesting we could just take the people out of the democracy and, I don't know what, run it all with machines and statistics.
Well, in a sense, this is based upon the people, but it's based upon a better version of the people. It's this kind of thing. I call this a government by simulated oracle. The thought is the knowledge that we need to govern is kind of out there, but how can we sort of extract it from the people? So in this sort of system, you're having everybody, in a sense, cast a vote, but then their vote is getting to some degree weighted based upon the knowledge that they have, but at the same time correcting for differences in demographics. So we can see things like, okay, this person is rich and white and favors free trade, and this person is poor and black and doesn't. Is the difference in the favoring of free trade because that person is poor and black, or is it because of education or something else? With basic statistics, you can figure that out.
That sounds like just putting an awful lot of power in the hands of economists and statisticians. I mean, who's going to be coming up with the statistics?
Really, the kinds of statistics here, they sound really mysterious. They're not. They're just first semester statistics. So the type of thing we're talking about now is the kind of thing where you could have all the data public and then news stations can evaluate it themselves and hire their own statisticians to sort of check the results to see if this is really what the enlightened public wants or not. You know, and one thing about this, too, is when I think about the fact that there's a demographic problem in that some people are much more likely to qualify as good voters on my theory than others, I think that's a problem. I think that shows an underlying injustice, but I don't think that necessarily means that it's injustice about who should vote. I think it's because we are mistreating certain groups. And so the thing here is to solve the problem by, you know, getting rid of the drug war or, you know, improving education and doing other kinds of things that are like getting rid of the things that disadvantage some people rather than just giving them the right to vote. I don't think giving them the right to vote or having them vote en masse is really doing them much good. And some evidence for that is just they've been voting and it hasn't really helped all that much.
Mm. I'm curious, do you vote?
Yeah, you know, I do sometimes vote. I don't always vote. As I said before, I have a what you might call an elitist theory of voting ethics and a populist view of civic virtue. I think there are lots and lots of ways to contribute to the common good and be a good citizen that don't involve voting. So I don't think there's an obligation to vote. I think there's maybe a general obligation to sort of serve the common good one way or another. And I think most people discharge that. But when I do vote, what I look at are not simply things like who are the people running and what is their voting record. That's simple, basic stuff, but that's not enough to be a good voter. I think you need to have a background in basic social sciences. You should know some basic political science and some basic economics and some basic sociology because you need to be able to evaluate the proposals that these people advocate. If somebody says, we're in a recession, so what I want to do is massively expand government spending to fight that recession, okay. Great. Well, now you need to know something about fiscal economics to know whether that works or not.
Jason Brennan is the author of The Ethics of Voting. He teaches strategy, economics, ethics, and public policy at Georgetown University. And that's it for our conversation on political engagement. When we come back, philosopher Nick Bostrom shares a dangerous idea, and the co-founder of OkCupid, a huge online dating site, crunches big data to reveal our collective secrets. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
So I'm Nick Bostrom. I'm a professor at Oxford University, where I direct the Future of Humanity Institute. And I've got a lot of dangerous ideas. One is this idea of information hazards and differential technological development. We have this assumption in academia and in much of the rest of society that progress is good, and it doesn't seem to matter much which direction we are supposed to be progressing in. We just want to move faster, develop more technologies of all different kinds, expand the frontier of what humans are able to do. However, if one takes a step back and one starts to think about the macro strategic situation for humanity, and if one is concerned about maximizing our long-term prospects, it's not at all so obvious that what would maximize our long-term prospects is moving forward as fast as possible. It might well be that there are certain technological areas where we would be better off with slower progress. Perhaps we ultimately want to have the technological capabilities that those areas of investigation could produce, but perhaps we want to have those capabilities later. So say there is some general purpose technology that could be used to do a lot of different things, maybe synthetic biology or nanotechnology. perhaps we would be better off developing that capability only after we have first gotten our act together slightly more so that we can avoid, for example, that technology being used to wage war. And more generally, we might want to think about technological development in terms of which technologies we want to get to before other technologies. So the principle of differential technological development would suggest that we should accelerate those technologies that are beneficial and that can protect against other technologies that are dangerous, and that those technologies should be retarded. So here's one example. Suppose there is one day going to be the ability to create a designer pathogen that is very lethal and has very high virulence. And suppose there one day is also going to be some like a general vaccine that could protect against this pathogen. Now, maybe there is a form of technological determinism that we will eventually develop both these technologies if they are feasible. However, it still matters which order we get them in. We would want the vaccine to come before the pathogen. From this principle of differential technological development, one general area to push on seems to be capacities that will improve our ability to make subsequent decisions more wisely. So doing research into ways of enhancing human cognition, either by biological cognitive enhancers or by improving the way we function together as an epistemic community, seem to be pretty robustly good. And we want those capabilities as soon as possible so that we will have a wiser and more capable version of humanity making subsequent decisions about where to go with our technological development.
Nick Bostrom directs Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute. And you can find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. How often do you go on Facebook? Personally, not all that often, but I'm in the minority. 50% of Americans under 35 check Facebook first thing in the morning. That's a lot of liking and sharing, and it all adds up to a lot of information about us. Sure, it's used to sell us stuff, but it can also be used as a kind of digital crystal ball, a window on human behavior. Christian Rutter is a math guy and the co-founder of OkCupid. It's one of the country's biggest online dating sites. Sarah Nix has been reading his new book, Dataclism, and she was wondering if it was all that digital dating information that piqued his interest.
Oh, yeah, I think you'd have to be a stone not to become curious after a while with all this stuff. I mean, you know, the data of just running the business of OkCupid involves who likes who hates who, people that want to sleep together, people that can't stand each other, how people describe themselves. I mean, all of these kind of fundamental questions about people or fundamental processes of life happen through the site. And so, you know, you're trying to make an interface so that people can do all these things, and you have to think about the behavior a little bit more in the abstract in order to do that. And yeah, the more you see of it, the more curious you get, for sure.
And for this book, you got access to behavioral data from other big sites too. What else did you use?
I generated my own sort of randomized set of people on Twitter and their tweets to research questions about how people write on Twitter. I have some data from a job site called ShiftGig. I did a lot of exploration in Google Trends and Google Books, which is kind of their collection of all the written work they've been able to get their hands on that you can search as if it were online. But also, I've been writing about OkCupid's data for about 5 years, but people at Google and people at Facebook have more intimate access to that data than I do. And there's other people doing work like that at Google and Facebook who are looking at the human side of their data and publishing what they've discovered. And so I wrote the book to look at their stuff, look at my stuff, and sort of tie it all together in a sort of state of the world as far as what data can tell.
Hmm. And what are some of the most surprising things you've run across?
Well, there's a funny irony in big data that I've discussed with other people who do similar work to me. The more time you spend with it, the more it just kind of confirms your cynical intuition about people. But I think in terms of things that did surprise me a little bit, I think the writing on Twitter is actually way more sophisticated than you'd think. When you get down and you analyze the syntax, you analyze the words people choose, it's actually in some ways more robust than, say, magazine-level journalism. Another thing, this is a little bit of a kind of a weird fact for the book, but some researchers from the UK using Facebook like patterns and like patterns alone, so no photos, no friend networks, none of that stuff. From just like patterns, they could predict your race with 95% accuracy, your sexuality with 88% accuracy, your gender with 85%, all the way down to with 60% accuracy, they could tell if your parents got divorced before you were 21, which is like, that's not even like a demographic detail. That's like a biographical fact of something that happened to you in your past. It's remarkable that you can tell that just from people liking books and movies and articles and stuff.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. And you definitely take pause because that's after a few years of data. Like, where is this going to be in 10 years, you know? Hmm.
And in the book, you don't just look at patterns of who's attracted to whom and why. Well, one of the chapters that I found most intriguing was the chapter on race.
Oh, yeah.
Could you just kind of do a thumbnail sketch of what you found about racial preferences or prejudices?
I viewed race through two lenses. One is through dating sites, not just OkCupid, but also other sites on our portfolio that are totally different. And I looked at who's hitting on who, basically, or who finds who attractive. And through across all the sites, back through time, the same pattern occurs. Black men and black women are underappreciated, as are Asian men. And this is basically, imagine it's as if somebody has stamped it. It's that consistent, it's that repetitive, has stamped it across all these data sets. And of course, you know, I think it's an open question whether the individual users who are sort of not replying to messages from black people, for example, whether they're actually, you know, racist or, I mean, you know, it's such a difficult question to answer what drives attraction, you know. But I think it does reveal what our society finds beautiful, for sure, because that's how people are judging each other en masse. There's definitely a same race preference kind of very broadly, and this is a known thing that scientists have measured in other arenas too, but you definitely see it in online dating. I mean, people prefer to date their own, I guess, to use a very clumsy way to put it. But beyond that preference, you do see that then there's the secondary stamp of this kind of, I guess, racist pattern that we were just talking about.
If I understand correctly, you found that race was the number one determining factor of who will reach out to whom on OkCupid. Is that right?
I mean, age is extremely important. I mean, it would be a tight race between
right.
age and race. But just to segue to sort of the second way I investigate race through this data, which kind of speaks to what we were talking about before, where people might have attitudes that they couldn't sort of float publicly, which has been hard to measure those attitudes before the internet came along because you don't know what someone's thinking. You know, you have to wait for them to tell you by and large. But Google search, you know, it's kind of like a priest, a doctor, a best friend, a personal shopper. It's
the
all
ultimate
these
confessor.
Right, exactly. It's kind of boiled all those things into one. And so, you know, there was a guy at Google named Seth Stevens Davidovitz who went through and he observed that in Obama's first campaign, for example, you know, whenever the campaign got tense, so, you know, the Iowa primary, Pennsylvania primary, Hillary concedes, you know, time and time again, there's spikes for searches for the N-word in Google, you know. Certain people are exercising their frustration over what's going on in the political sphere through this search bar. And then, of course, the all-time peak for searches for the N-word was the night Obama was elected. And the only two peaks that have been close since then are the night when Trayvon Martin's murder was first publicized and then, you know, a year or so later when Zimmerman was acquitted. So it's very interesting to watch. It's like looking at that line in Google Trends, which anybody can go do. It's almost like the a kind of heart monitor, but for like a different type of organ inside people. You see the searches go up, you see them go down, and it's just a very fascinating view into the kind of mental state of sort of racial angst or animosity in this country. You know, these search words kind of behind closed doors are still incredibly common, and it gives some view into that kind of backroom conversation about race in this country. I mean, and to be clear, like the N-word, a little bit less so now, but since Google has been collecting it since 2004, you know, it's more searched for than apple pie out there. There's a lot of common search terms that are more rare than the N-word out there. So it's not an outlier like you'd think it would be if you just listened to people talking on the street.
Well, and this leads to a kind of overarching question that I have. And, you know, what I'm wondering is there's something different about what we do during those private moments with the internet and how we interact with the world in person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people reading about your research and your findings see it as a sign of our hypocrisy. But I think that there's a more nuanced way to look at that somehow. That somehow those private opinions and the public actions combine to make up a whole person.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I think it does show a lot of people's hypocrisy, for sure. I mean, you know, and who isn't a hypocrite, really, you know? But also, it's an interesting thing. I've thought about this a lot, this discrepancy, or people are just willing to, like, unleash their id, you know, online, especially when they're anonymous, as you basically are when you're searching for things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird that that it is such an uglier creature than people out in the real world, you know? And in a kind of counterintuitive way, it actually speaks to the value of society. Like, it is in some ways comforting that the fact we have kind of all agreed together to suppress these kind of horrible things. If people acted on the street like they acted on Google, it would be a rough world, you know? But we, when we're interacting with people in person, there's norms, there's etiquette, there's taboos, and, like, it shows that those things actually have value. I mean, obviously, norms can be oppressive, for sure. But it means that the fact that the two things are different, our public and our sort of more private or intimate, it shows that, like, fundamentally we do actually care about being acceptable people, you know, en masse, you know? And I think in a kind of a counterintuitive way, I think it's that is an encouraging thing to see.
Hmm. Most of the data that you've had access to is relatively young, you know, compared to kind of traditional longitudinal behavioral studies, right? It covers, you know, the last 6 or 7 years. But what potential do you think is out there for big data sets as they grow over time to show us about how our society is changing?
Well, I mean, even just to pick up this Google example here, you know, I mean, Google's been reporting this stuff on Google Trends for 10 years, since 2004. And imagine that's a blink of an eye in a kind of historical time frame. But imagine it going 50 more years, and who knows where searches for the N-word are going to be. You know what I mean? Like, it could be down to zero. And what would that say about our society? I think it would be a tremendously encouraging, just for example. You know, and it's a thing that you couldn't measure via a survey over that amount of time. I think the cultural implications of the fact that people are liking all the stuff on Facebook, and they're going to like different things in 5 years, they're going to like different things in 10 years. And you can, you know, take the temperature of people's attitudes, again, in a way that a survey is never going to be able to address.
You know, you mentioned when we first started talking that some of the things that you've come to discover through your research have reinforced some cynicism that you have about human nature. And I wonder if you will have kind of human study fatigue at some point. Do you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely possible. Yes, it's possible. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love learning, and I love writing about this stuff, and I especially love thinking about this stuff. But, you know, like, working for a dating site will it grows you up quick, let me put it that way. You see some crazy things. But, you know, I mean, I love it. And I guess in the book especially, I try to have a sense of humor about the whole thing. You know, that's what keeps me going through all this stuff, is the possibility that there might be a good joke at the end of some of it.
Christian Rutter is the co-founder and president of the dating website OkCupid and the author of Dataclism, Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. He talked with Sarah Nix. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tunkekar produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Joe Hartke engineered today's show. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.